Hello, this is Keith Pannell, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. I'm still on location. I'm down here in East Texas, and today I'm at Galveston, or in Galveston, at the Galveston National Laboratory, which is a breakout that used to be part of the University of Texas Medical Branch. We're going to be talking to the director of the facility, Dr. Jim LaDuke. And Jim, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Before we get into what is the National Laboratory, what you do here, why are you here, more fundamental at the beginning is, why are you a scientist? How did you get into this game of science?
Good question. I was born and raised in Southern California, and even as a kid, I just kind of liked animals, and especially wild animals. So every time I caught a snake or something and brought it home, my mother would yell and scream, but it was great sport and all. And so I ended up going to university and ended up studying zoology. And I ended up with a degree in zoology. And then during my senior year, my professor of mammalogy got a phone call from his graduate school buddy, who was at that time at the Smithsonian Institution. And he asked if my professor had any students that would like to go to Africa and collect animals.
How could you resist?
How could I resist? You know, a toss of the coin, I said it sounded like fun. The fact that this was during the peak of the Vietnam War, I thought this was a good option as well. So I took off and worked for the Smithsonian. It ended up to be 2 years living in a tent in West Africa, collecting rats and mice and bats. And my job was to pick the ectoparasites off them and then skin them and stuff them and prepare them as study skins for the Smithsonian. So,
and the point of that then is to find out what types of parasites would be prevalent in that location as opposed to, say, Southern California.
What types were present in Africa? And this was an Army-sponsored project, or Department of Defense-sponsored project, and it included the entire continent of Africa. And so others had worked in East Africa and South Africa.
I mean, the whole of Africa in 2 years would be...
No, this had been going on for quite some time.
Right. That's very exciting for a young man straight out of college.
At 21, it was a great experience. I'm not sure I'd encourage my kids to do it today, but at that time, it was wonderful.
So what did you do when you finished this two-year stint?
Well, actually, at the end of the first year, I got my draft notice, my pre-induction physical to report to the Pentagon for my physical. So I was able to get...
To the Pentagon?
To the Pentagon, because my address was with the State Department in Washington, and so my mail was coming to the embassy in Ghana. So suffice to say, I went to our program officer, got a request for an extension, was able to come back for the second year, and then I was able to apply and was accepted into the military under a direct commission. So I came in as an officer.
That's always a nice way to join the military.
Well, you know, I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but given the choice of infantryman or officer, I figured that was the better choice.
And so after service, then, or did the military help you go back to graduate school?
I ended up having a career in the military, and I had never in my wildest dreams thought of myself as a soldier, but in fact I met some of the smartest people in the world, had some of the greatest experiences both scientifically and personally, and met lifelong friends, and along the way bought me a PhD. So,
where did you get your degree from?
I went to UCLA.
And still studied parasites?
I studied public health at that time, and epidemiology, and specifically virus diseases as they exist in nature.
Okay, well, viruses are all in the public attention these days.
They are indeed.
And I've done enough of these radio shows. Every time I talk to someone about parasitology, virology, I'm always nervous. As soon as I leave my office or something, there's a lot of things out there waiting for us.
Let me reassure you, we do not give any free samples.
No, that's encouraging. So let's talk a little bit about then the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. That's traditionally, I think it was the first medical school in the state of Texas, one of the oldest at least. but it's still here as UTMB, but that's now correct. It's got this other designation, the Galveston National Laboratory, right, like Los Alamos National Laboratory, Argonne National Lab. Tell us about what does that mean?
Well, right after 9/11 and concerned about the threat of terrorism in general and bioterrorism specifically, NIH invested in the construction of two national laboratories, one of which is here and the other one is at Boston University, and a number of regional laboratories. The national laboratories have biocontainment levels to biosafety level 4, which is the highest level of biocontainment. The regional biosafety laboratories have only BSL 3, which is a step below, but still able to handle a lot of pathogens.
What's the difference? I mean, is it a logarithmic scale?
The premise for biological safety levels is really twofold. Number one, the degree of protection for the individual working in the laboratory, and number two, the degree of protection for the environment, the engineering backbone that goes into ensuring that nothing spills out into the local environment. So biological safety level 2, which is kind of the entry level here, we handle common things like seasonal influenza, a number of bacterial pathogens and others. And there are certain restrictions there. You have to not eat no food or anything like that. The idea is you keep your fingers out of your mouth and your eyes and your nose while you're working in there. Then at biological safety level 3, it's a step higher, and we have a lot of containment, including directional airflow. We use more sophisticated equipment. We use biological safety cabinets at all levels, and these are just, we call them hoods, and they're benches that have recycled air and help purify the...
And big filters.
Exactly.
Get to a very fine level.
Exactly, right? Exactly.
And then when you get to 4...
And at biological safety level 4 is really the big leagues. You work inside a spacesuit, so you completely have contained air. There's behind the scenes an enormous amount of mechanics that just provide that air for you. There's liquid waste management so that everything that leaves the laboratory is sterilized. All the air, both coming in and going out, goes through HEPA filters, high-efficiency filters. So there's lots and lots of redundancy and safety precautions taken.
And so the point of all that, then, is that at level 2 you can deal with, as you say, the influenza virus, which, of course, is a major problem for the whole world. I mean, we tend to dismiss it, oh, it's just the flu. But a lot of people die from the flu.
A lot of people die from the flu. And, in fact, of all the pathogens we work on, influenza is one of the most significant, I think, simply because it's so easily transmitted and so rapidly transmitted.
And the DNA mutates a lot, so there's a constantly new form of flu.
Exactly.
But then you think, well, at the beginning of getting the shot, they're not quite sure what the particular virus that's important is going to be.
That's a great point.
And so is it a good idea to get 2 or to wait halfway through the season and then get your flu shot because you may be protected better?
Let me explain how that works.
Please.
The World Health Organization, for many years, has coordinated global surveillance of seasonal influenza. And that simply means that they collect what's being transmitted around the world. So in the wintertime in the southern hemisphere, they're finding out what's circulating. Then in the northern hemisphere, they do the same thing in our wintertime. So here in the northern hemisphere, about February, these reference laboratories, primarily CDC for the United States, takes a look at everything that's in circulation. And they compare that with similar laboratories in Asia and Europe and also in Australia. And they say, okay, what's in circulation now? What's new? What's the antigenic component of this? And then in February, they meet at the World Health Organization and they come out with recommendations for the vaccine that will then be given the following fall in the Northern Hemisphere. And they do the same thing again for the Southern Hemisphere in September for those recommendations. So you're always at least 6 months behind the schedule. So
right.
Sometimes it's a good match, sometimes it's not such a good match. And that's why one of the reasons that there's a tremendous amount of investment in the basic research of how to make a universal influenza vaccine, a vaccine that doesn't have this year-to-year change. And there are some characteristics of the virus that would allow us to make such a vaccine, at least in theory. We're not there yet, however.
So that's the holy grail. I mean, and you can see from your knowledge of the science that this is doable.
We hope it's doable. Now, obviously, if there was an easy way to do it, we'd only get influenza once and you'd never get influenza again. Well, we get influenza more than once because the virus changes, and there's lots of reasons for that. But the bottom line is that sometimes there is broad-spectrum immunity.
And so down here at the GNL, the Galveston National Laboratory, you have an active program in the flu virus.
We work on influenza, both seasonal influenza as well as avian influenza and the oddball strains that you've heard about in the news popping up in Asia especially.
And so my comment at the beginning is probably totally wrong, as my comments usually are, that in fact it's not much point waiting halfway through the season to get your flu shot.
No.
It hasn't been changed very much.
The vaccine's not going to change. Whatever's available in October is going to be the same vaccine that's available in November, December.
And so these other things, like there's something called Tamiflu. Tell us, what is that? That's a commercial
Tamiflu sort of is an antiviral drug.
Right.
So vaccines generate your own immunity so that you're protected against infection. If you become infected, then you want a drug that specifically addresses the virus itself, and Tamiflu is one of those drugs.
And how effective is that against all the different viruses? I mean, it seems to me, it makes a lot of money, I suppose. A lot of people go out and purchase it and use it, but what's the efficacy?
Well, the efficacy varies depending on when you start. If you take it early in the course of disease, within the first 24 to 48 hours, it's quite efficacious. If you're longer than that, if you've been sick for 4 or 5 days or a week, it's probably going to be less efficacious, but it still can be beneficial, and especially if you have a very severe disease. So even if you're hospitalized, your physician may, in fact, give you Tamiflu, even though you've been well into the disease.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with the head of the Galveston National Laboratory in Galveston, Texas, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Most of us in this country got an MMR vaccine, which almost eradicated measles here. Until the vaccine was developed, the virus used to infect 500,000 children in the U.S. every year.
But today, a study is using the measles virus to kill cancer cells. The approach of using viruses as an anti-cancer treatment is not new. Since the 1950s, researchers have investigated this potential, called oncolytic viral therapy.
This newest approach with an engineered measles virus looks promising. Called MVNIS, researchers modified this virus by inserting a gene that makes a protein called the sodium iodide symporter.
This protein normally helps concentrate iodine in the human thyroid. So when MVNIS infects cells, this protein also binds iodine. That way, when radioactive iodine is injected into a patient, the infected cells become visible under certain imaging techniques.
This allowed scientists to follow the virus as it left healthy cells alone but targeted tumor cells. Ultra-high doses of the virus were injected into two women with end-stage myeloma, an incurable blood cancer.
It works because the virus uses as receptor a protein found on the surface of myeloma tumor cells. This allows MVNIS virus to enter, replicate, and kill them.
Both women in the trial showed a rapid decline in myeloma cells. One became cancer-free and remains in remission. The cancer returned in the other woman, but the treatment prolonged her life.
The researchers plan to treat a larger group of patients in a second clinical trial. They say it's too early to declare their treatment a cure, but it's certainly promising.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Jim LaDuke, the head of the Galveston National Laboratory, and we're talking about viruses, vaccines, and even sort of antiviral drugs. Now, flu must be easy to make a vaccine for, because we're making it lots and lots of times every year.
Right.
What makes it easy for that? And now we'll come on to the more current topic of the Ebola virus, which I know this institution is actively looking into. What makes something easy as opposed to difficult?
Well, let me start by saying we don't make vaccines here. We do the upstream research that helps to design and define how vaccines might be made by the commercial industry. The way that we make influenza vaccines has been around literally for decades, and it hasn't changed much. The challenge going forward, as we said earlier, is to try and identify more efficient ways to protect the host against influenza infection. And one of those is to try and make a generic vaccine that would protect against all strains of influenza. That's much more difficult, and part of the reason is that this part of the virus that your body sees for all viruses is kind of hidden away, and so it's not easily accessible to your immune system. So the trick is to find a site that's always available to your immune system, yet sufficiently sensitive to antibody that you can actually protect against that infection. Without going into some details, there are some targets, but it's a challenge to make them work.
So then let's move on to the Ebola. I mean, currently, you know, it's an extremely worrying concept,
right. But
it does seem it's beginning to be less distributed in the host country, in Liberia anyway. And the Nigerian government have claimed that they're free of this
right.
at the moment. So there are some positive signs coming out, but at any moment you can have an eruption. Tell us, what is the Ebola virus?
So Ebola is a very unique virus that was new to science in 1976, was first discovered by an outbreak that occurred in what was then Zaire. Concurrent with that outbreak, a second strain of Ebola, a somewhat different virus, occurred simultaneously in southern Sudan. So in the same year, and basically at the same time, we had the discovery of two different strains of, we call these filoviruses because they're long, filamentous-looking strands of virus, very odd-looking viruses to begin with. So we had these two outbreaks occurring. The one in Zaire killed about 80 to 90% of the people that were infected. The one in South Sudan killed only 50%. But still, that's a lot of people dead. But anyway, that was the start of our understanding of Ebola virus.
When you say 80%, 50%, does that mean that 50%, for example, we'll take the nice number, the nicer of the two, that without any treatment, these people will simply shake it off like you can shake off flu?
No. All of these people were very seriously ill.
Okay.
A few of them survived. At that time, we didn't recognize any asymptomatic infections, people, or mild infections. And these people were hospitalized, but this is in the mid-1970s, in the middle of the jungle, basically, with very primitive healthcare systems. That said, the mortality rate for the Zaire strain of Ebola has consistently been about 70% over the years.
And this virus, just to go back a little, came from direct interactions with animals. I mean, that's
At that time, we didn't know where it came from.
Right.
And in fact, on the investigations, it looked like most of the transmission was facilitated by reuse of needles and inadequate sterilization. That said, it's become apparent over the years that the virus exists in nature. probably exists in a bat host of fruit bats, probably, but we're still trying to nail that down. Somehow the virus transfers, at least in Central Africa, frequently to wild animals, often gorillas or chimpanzees, other large apes, and they behave just like humans. They get very sick and die, and then hunters will come across them, and the outbreak will start by people slaughtering the animal, processing it for food, and they become infected themselves. We, outside of rural Africa, we often learn about these because somebody goes to the hospital and dies, and as part of their treatment, they infect the medical staff, and the next thing you know, the doctor and all the nurses are dead as well, and the World Health Organization or somebody finds out about it.
What is the role of the GNL in our fight for not having Ebola become as bad as in theory it could be?
The GNL works. We have scientists working on Ebola, all strains of Ebola, but we also work on other viral hemorrhagic fevers that cause serious disease and some bacterial diseases. But in the BL4, the spacesuit lab, we work on the really dangerous pathogens that will kill you and where we don't have any treatments. So what do? First, we try and understand how the virus makes you sick. What's the pathogenesis? How it replicates so that we can identify points that might be susceptible for intervention. And the intervention is obviously, number one, how to protect yourself from getting infected. Make a vaccine for it. If you become infected, how do you treat it? Development of drugs, specifically antiviral drugs, or therapeutic interventions, ways to modulate your body's response to that infection. And the third set of activities is diagnostic tests. How do you recognize that you have this particular pathogen?
And before you really get sick with the symptoms and become dangerous.
Exactly. And, you know, if you live in Africa or wherever and you have a febrile disease, well, your clinician says, a mild flu-like illness, call me in the morning.
You know? Take an aspirin, go home.
Exactly.
Maybe a whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. So our job is to make sure that we can diagnose it, prevent it if possible, and treat it if necessary.
So when an outbreak like this occurs, Do you suddenly find funds become available for you to hire more researchers to investigate that topic, or are they... A lot of people taking off of other projects in order to do this crash course?
Well, that's a great question, and science doesn't work like that.
No.
You know, you need to make an investment up front. So the fact that we are working on promising drugs and vaccines today is a reflection of the investments that have been made primarily by NIH a decade ago or more. And science works incrementally, builds on the shoulders of those that have gone behind you. So
Before you,
exactly, right. And so the idea is that the fact that we have products that are promising today reflects the investments that have been made in the past, the fact that people have been working behind the scenes quietly on these for many, many years.
But you are concentrating personnel now, I presume, on the Ebola.
There's a lot of interest in Ebola today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, are you... Yeah. You're sort of marshalling your resources here at the GNL.
Yes. Yes, we are.
One of the things that you alluded to earlier and that we tend to think we know is that the flu virus is constantly mutating.
Right.
All right. Does it appear that, as we see it at the moment, that the Ebola virus is going to be similar in the sense that it's, you know, it's a problem?
You know, that's a great question. And one of the many frustrations that we in the scientific community have today is that this current outbreak in West Africa has been going on approaching a year, started in December of last year, as best we can tell. So that's a long time. Most of the outbreaks that we've had with Ebola and their close relatives have been controlled in a matter of weeks to a few months. So we're now looking at a virus that has been through human-to-human transmission for many, many generations, probably more generations than have ever existed in the history of mankind. what happens to that virus? We know that this is an RNA virus and that it has the ability to adapt. So how much adaptation has occurred? The frustration comes in that we haven't been getting, we, the global community, not just the GNO, but scientists around the world, have really not had access to the current viruses. Everybody is focusing, rightly so, on saving lives and interrupting transmission. The scientific part of it, how much has the virus changed? We don't really know.
So that's not really known at this moment.
It's not known.
And well, I mean, naively, one thinks that these days you can get the genome of anything for $300. Bang, 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 and you have it.
We have the tools to do that. And in June or July, about 100 isolates or genomes were sequenced from one site in Sierra Leone. But that's really the only real data we have.
And that was done here or somewhere
that
else?
That was done elsewhere.
Okay.
But I mean, the scientific community. And so it showed there's a lot of diversity, but you've probably talked previously about viruses. They kind of exist in swarms rather than just a single genotype, if you will. So how much of that just reflects what goes on normally versus is there a trend towards acquiring different characteristics or adapting to more efficient human-to-human transmission? And we don't know that yet.
Well, I understand also that the GNL is got a very, very active program in what I would call vector-borne disease. And in fact, one of the major establishments in North America.
Right.
Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about what does that mean and what are you looking at?
So our unique resources here are the ability to take the naturally occurring vectors, and by vectors I mean mosquitoes and ticks and sometimes sandflies, the insects or arthropods that transmit primarily virus diseases. Your listeners will know about West Nile virus for sure. Certainly been an important disease here in Texas. Dengue. Plenty of dengue throughout Latin America, threatening to come inside the country all the time. So these are diseases that are transmitted by mosquitoes. There are other, often more severe diseases that are transmitted by ticks. And so in our highest containment level, we have a very unique resource, the ability to conduct tick transmission studies with the natural vector of ticks infected with these exotic viruses. For example, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, a disease that occurs, as you might imagine, in Crimea, all the way down through most of Africa.
Wow.
And this is...
And what do you infect? Mice,
we infect
rats?
Mice, laboratory animals, primarily mice or rabbits.
And they serve as a good surrogate for
they
people.
They serve as a surrogate for people. But this really allows us to look at the virus as it replicates not only in the vector, in the tick, but also in the host. And from the virus's perspective, it's really got two very different environments to replicate in. These cold-blooded arthropods and this warm-blooded host. And it's so biologically, it's a very unique situation. And I can tell you there's a lot of viruses around the world that are transmitted by arthropods that are of human health importance and are very poorly understood. So this is a very unique part of our portfolio.
So Professor Jim LeDuc, the head of the Galveston National Laboratory here in Galveston, Texas, it's been delightful to have you here, and I thank you very much. And
pleasure.
We, of course, always thank Norma Martinez for putting the program together. And obviously, we'd like to thank you, the listener, for being there. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Diana Schultz has been named new Chief Executive Officer for Kindred Hospital in El Paso. Kindred is a 62-bed facility that provides care to patients who require extended recovery time. Schultz comes to Kindred with more than 8 years of hospital CEO experience in Corpus Christi, Texas. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital.